All right. Thank you guys for your attention. I know it's already been a long morning. We're just getting started. Normally, when I come to Aspen, I'm asked to speak on issues specific to marijuana driving. I'm not talking about that issue today, but in fact, I will be back in Denver at a nationwide DUI conference that's being held the first weekend of the first week of July in Denver. So if there's folks that are interested in that, you can talk to me later. I'll tell you more about that conference, and I will be speaking there about the latest science specific to marijuana and driving and DUI. But for today, we're going to talk about the safety and efficacy of cannabis. And we're going to talk about this through the lens of the case that Lauren mentioned in the introduction. About 18 months ago, I had the privilege of being in federal court with two members of the National Normal Legal Committee, Xenia Gilg and Heather Burke. They had filed a motion that had been accepted by the court, arguing that, in fact, the science specific to cannabis today was incongruent with the Schedule I criteria of marijuana. And in fact, because it was so, they argued that the federal court ought to revisit this issue. And for the first time since, I believe, 1973, the court agreed. And the court argued that because there's a footnote in Raich v. Gonzalez back in 2005 that says if credible science comes to light that casts doubt on the accuracy of the scheduling of a particular drug in Schedule I, then there is an obligation for the federal court to hear and weigh that new evidence. And the federal judge in this case, Kimberly Mueller, agreed that in the motions that we filed, we had facts, we had science, we had evidence, we had new scientific evidence that had come to light that cast doubt on the notion that cannabis met the three-prong criteria of a Schedule I drug. So that's how we got there. Now, unfortunately, but not surprisingly, the judge in this case was holding or was going to judge the evidence we presented by a very low standard. She imposed the rational review standard, which essentially said or says that as long as there is some conceivable reason to keep marijuana in Schedule I, then the judge was going to do just that. She said such a classification comes before the court, quote, bearing a strong presumption of validity, and the challenger must outweigh every negative conceivable basis for which it could be supported. So essentially, we knew going in the court that we were facing an exceptionally high burden. Because the federal prosecutors made it clear in their motions, they said, look, at the end of the day, despite any of the evidence that's going to be heard in court in these hearings, Congress isn't even required to be right. Nor does it matter if the basis on which Congress made its decision turns out to be wrong. They said the facts really don't matter here. All that's required is that members of Congress could rationally have believed that the actions they made at the time would advance a legitimate interest. So that was their bar. And they said, look, just because qualified experts, like the majority of experts who are familiar with the science at this point, just because some of these experts might disagree, it's not for the court essentially to pick a side and say one group of experts seems to be more credible than the other group of experts, and therefore the court's going to decide one or the other. They said if there is this disagreement among well-recognized experts, the statute simply has to stand. So we knew that going in, but we still wanted to utilize this opportunity to bring this evidence to light, to have our day in court. And we were initially promised 3 days in court by Judge Mueller. When all was said and done, she gave us 5.5 days. Now, one of the reasons I think this issue is important to discuss now is because there is an expectation that the DEA is going to be issuing its own recommendation with regard to the scheduling of marijuana based on two citizen petitions before it, and that they're going to make a decision this July. So there's again, quite a bit of discussion among the public, this narrative about marijuana and its scheduling and where marijuana conceivably ought to be scheduled based on the available evidence. So we're hearing that discussion again now. We're going to hear even more about this discussion in July, when and if the DEA makes its rulings. And I'm going to talk a little bit at the very end of this presentation about where I think this issue needs to go with regard to scheduling. But what was very interesting in this case is that for 5.5 days, the federal government laid out their best argument as to why they believe marijuana ought to stay in Schedule 1 and why they believe cannabis meets the 3 criteria of a Schedule 1 drug. So we know what their best arguments are now. I'm going to present to you those arguments, and I'm going to present the way we rebutted many of those arguments using the latest and most available science. So here were the participants in our federal trial. We had Gregory Carter from the Washington School of Medicine. We had Carl Hart, who will actually be speaking to you on the third day of this conference, a neuroscientist from Columbia University, arguably one of the smartest people in the room when it comes to any topic of marijuana science. He was also a fantastic witness on the stand. We had Philip Denny, who is a retired family practitioner who had guided literally thousands of patients overseeing their use of medical marijuana during his career. We had Chris Conrad, who's a court-qualified expert on yields of marijuana grows. And the federal government proffered one single witness, Bertha Madras, who has a degree in psychiatry. In psychology, and she's a former demand reduction director at the Office of National Drug Control Policy. What's a little bit interesting about this witness list is that Greg Carter has published a number of peer-reviewed gold standard studies looking at the use of medical cannabis treatment in human beings. Carl Hart works at Margaret Haney's lab at Columbia University and possesses a Schedule 1 license to work with Schedule 1 licensed drugs and Schedule 2 licensed drugs. He's most known for his clinical research on crack and methamphetamine, but has also done clinical research using cannabis. He works with actual drugs like marijuana in human subjects and writes those findings in clinical journals. Philip Denny works hands-on as a family practitioner and has done so with thousands of patients on medical marijuana. Bertha Madras works with a couple mice. She's never worked with a human being in a clinical trial in her life. And her degree, as you know, is in psychology. I would have argued she was a very uninformed witness. I knew Bertha Madras well before this hearing because she made headlines some years ago when she was still with ONDCP, when she argued that EMTs and first responders should not be, by law, should not be allowed to carry overdose antidote drugs like naloxone, because she thought that set a bad example for drug addicts if people that took drugs they could potentially overdose on knew that they had a rescue medication available, they might simply continue to use drugs. That would be a bad thing. She thought there was a public health reason why we should not have access to those drugs. That's the sort of person the federal government was relying on in this trial or in this hearing. So you guys all know this, I suppose. Here's the Schedule 1 definition under the CSA. Marijuana and all of its active constituents, according to the Controlled Substances Act of 1970, meet these 3 criteria. The drug has the highest potential for abuse of any other drug that could possibly be scheduled. The drug has no currently accepted medical use and treatment in the United States. You know, the United States, where half the states now have laws that by statute say physicians can recommend marijuana, those United States. And they say there's a lack of accepted safety for use of the drug under medical supervision. So in other words, if you were hospitalized and you had round-the-clock care with doctors and nurses and hooked up the machines that were monitoring your heart rate, even in that situation, we could not administer marijuana to a person in that situation because marijuana is too dangerous. That's the criteria. That is what this administration, every administration going back to 1970, maintains The science is consistent that marijuana fits those criteria. We were arguing that the science contradicts marijuana being listed as a Schedule I drug because it did not fit those criteria. So I'm going to take the government's claim sort of one by one, and then we're going to discuss the science that we how we responded to these claims. So Bertha Madras said that there is no question that marijuana fits the first criteria, that it possesses a high potential for abuse. She said there's extensive data and practical experience to support this conclusion that it has a high potential for abuse, and in fact, marijuana is actually abused. The way she substantiated this claim was she said, well, just look around you. Marijuana is illegal, yet lots of people use it anyway. It's inconceivable to Bertha Madras that a majority of people could be violating the law by engaging this behavior unless they were abusing the drug, unless they were, in other words, addicted to marijuana. Because if they weren't, they would be following the law. This was her number one argument. Then she said, and look at all the people in drug treatment for marijuana. Well, obviously, if they weren't abusing marijuana, they wouldn't be in treatment now, would they? And then she said, look at the DSM-5. And it acknowledges that there is such a thing as marijuana dependence. So we're going to talk about those issues. This first issue, her notion that there's all sorts of use of marijuana going on. Well, certainly to some degree there is. There's certainly greater use of marijuana in the population than there is for any other illicit substance. But if we look statistically, we see that by time most subjects who experiment with marijuana turn age 30, this group, of course, being the exception, but for the majority of people who begin using cannabis, typically fairly early in age, by time they turn 30, they cut down significantly on their marijuana use or they cease it using marijuana altogether. And in fact, we had a really interesting study that came out just late last week by researchers at the University of Washington in St. Louis, Missouri. That's right, Washington University. And it said not only are fewer young people using marijuana over the last decade and a half or so, but more importantly, what they define as problematic use of marijuana by young people. Young people using marijuana in inappropriate situations like before school. Young people using marijuana habitually. Self-reported incidents of problematic marijuana abuse by young people had fell by 24%. And this was between 2012 and 2013, a period of time where we're seeing an uptick in marijuana use among adults, and we're seeing a significant changes in the status of marijuana under a number of state laws. So even within sort of this perfect storm where our opponents have said, we're going to see all sorts of increases in young people's use of marijuana, we're going to see it leading to more problematic use, we found the opposite. We also see that in jurisdictions where individuals have the opportunity to access marijuana legally, well, then they begin to substitute marijuana for other more conventional substances they might have otherwise used, whether we're talking about prescription medicines or whether we're talking about alcohol. And we see this in a number of different studies that have now been published both throughout the United States and throughout Canada, that when patients or even just when the general population has legal access to marijuana, they do not use as much alcohol as they previously did, and they tend to cut down on their use of other conventional medications. So we see this sort of substitution effect. And we see this most specifically with the reduction in the use of opioids. We have studies both published in the Journal of the American Medical Association and by the National Bureau of Economic Research showing that in states where medical marijuana is legal, we see lower overall use of opioid use, and we see lower opioid-related mortality. Fewer people die in those states from the use of opioids, both prescription opioids and illicit opioids. And that's by a factor of about 4. We also have plenty of evidence now showing that marijuana is an exit drug, that in fact, many people, when they begin using marijuana, they begin using marijuana as a substitute or as a way to cut down on their use of other illicit or more dangerous drugs, and again, particularly the opioids. We have now about half a dozen studies showing that individuals who are opioid dependent and are seeking to wean themselves from opioids and are going through conventional outpatient therapy, that if they continue to use moderate rates of marijuana during that outpatient therapy, they have greater retention to their opioid dependency treatment. They're more likely to finish the program. They're less likely to go back to using opiates. Now, what about this notion that we have all of these people seeking treatment for marijuana? Well, this was a shock to Bertha Madras. I'm sure it's not a surprise to many of you that very few people voluntarily self-identify themselves and say, I'm somebody who's eligible for marijuana treatment. I need marijuana treatment. In fact, what we find is that the majority of people who are in so-called treatment programs for marijuana are there because they're arrested for marijuana use, typically possession, and they were given an option by the court. They said, you can do some time, or you can go to this treatment program. And if you complete the treatment program, this incident is largely going to go away. So not surprisingly, the majority of people, when given that choice, choose to go to the treatment program. In fact, we see that over 6 out of 10 of individuals in marijuana treatment are there because the criminal justice system ordered them there. By contrast, if we look at all the other illicit drugs, we see that only 37% of individuals in treatment for all of the rest of the drugs are there because the criminal justice system put them there. We see that only about 15% of people in marijuana treatment are self-referred. That means they voluntarily chose to put themselves there. And this is really telling. These data all come from the federal government. SAMHSA stands for the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Association Administration. We see that nearly 40% of adults who enter drug treatment for marijuana, they haven't used marijuana in the last month. So clearly these individuals have already stopped or ceased using their cannabis before they ever enter marijuana treatment. They've done that because probably when they were facing trial, their defense attorney said, hey, you probably want to get off the marijuana while you're on trial for a marijuana violation. So they do. But then they have to go to treatment anyway as a outcome of the charge. And so this is important, too. According to the TEDS data, 85% of marijuana admissions receive ambulatory services. That means they're not staying in a room. They're not being overseen. It means they check in with their counselor and then they leave. That's not the case with most people assigned drug treatment for other drugs. Most people have inpatient treatment. The marijuana designees overwhelmingly receive outpatient treatment. So again, this sort of dependency does not fit any conventional definition of dependency like we're talking with other substances. Now, again, we know that marijuana is classified as a Schedule I controlled substance, which means as a definition, it is to have the highest potential for dependency. Yet, when we look to scientific literature, we see that cannabis's dependence liability, there's a consensus that's only about 9%. It means about 1 out of 11 people that try cannabis at some point during their life use of the drug will use the drug habitually. Dependence liability is not the same thing as addiction. It's actually a much lower, more amorphous standard. I have some colleagues that take issue with this percentage. They think it's too high. I let them fight that battle. It's not my battle to fight. I don't believe we need to show that cannabis is without potential risk or that cannabis is innocuous. We simply need to show that cannabis possesses an acceptable level of safety and risk comparable to the standards that society upholds other substances, be they recreational substances or therapeutic substances too. And we see by this chart, cannabis clearly falls within that range. In fact, it's at the low end of that range. Its dependence liability is very little different than caffeine. It's the same as anxiolytics, like your benzodiazepine drugs, and it's certainly much lower than alcohol and tobacco, for instance. And again, if you read the DSM-5 and you read about marijuana-related use disorders and you read about caffeine-related use disorders, it's practically the same language, just cut and paste from one section of that book to another section of the book. Very, very similar. You ask people who use marijuana, do you spend more time than you care for thinking about marijuana? Do you want to cut down on your marijuana use through the day, but you have difficulty doing it? You ask those people the same questions about caffeine, they also say yes, and that's why you see very similar criteria. So then we get to the second prong of the Schedule I criteria, this idea of no accepted medical use in the United States. And Ms. Madras was very firm on this. She said that a substantial majority, or perhaps even the vast majority, of scientists familiar with the literature and the research attest that at this time, marijuana has no confirmed medical application. Then she said, it's the components. If there's any value here in marijuana, it's in the components, but God forbid, it's certainly not in the whole plant. And then she said, look, you guys just don't have any gold standard clinical trials that the FDA would ever accept regarding this question of safety and efficacy. So let's address these concerns that she brought to the court. First of all, we see widespread acceptance among the medical health community and the public health community in favor of marijuana as a medicine. We know that there's a number of leading medical organizations like the Epilepsy Foundation of America, the American Nurses Association, the American Public Health Association that are on record, that have enacted resolutions supportive of the use of marijuana as a medicine. So what's Bertha Madras talking about? Well, what she's talking about is the fact that the AMA, the American Medical Association, is not on record saying that marijuana is in fact a medicine. Now, they're on record saying a whole lot of other wishy-washy things, like it shouldn't be in Schedule I, we need to have more studies, we need to have longer studies, yada-da-yada-da-yada. But they don't come out point-blank like the American Nurses Association, for instance, and says patients should have access to medical marijuana now. Now, what's interesting to me is all this weight and credibility that the AMA is given in their position, because the AMA represents fewer than 15% of all acting general practitioners in this country. And that membership rate has been going down year after year after year. This is what the minority of people who practice medicine think. Why the hell do we care? Why do we care about the position of a membership group where the overwhelming majority of doctors aren't members? And the doctors that have been members until recently have said, you know, I don't want to be a member anymore. This group doesn't represent me. I don't think the AMA is relevant anymore. It's only really relevant to people like Bertha Madras. And it sounds good on paper. You say the American Medical Association, the general public knows what you're talking about. They don't know we're talking about a medical association that's on the outs, that can barely keep its membership rolls up anymore. So again, no accepted medical use. Then what's going on here? We've got 25 states and the District of Columbia that by statute recognize the medical use of cannabis. We have 16 additional states that recognize the medical use or therapeutic use of a constituent in cannabis, cannabidiol. We have Congress now, 2 years in a row, passing provisions in their budgets saying that the Department of Justice shall not interfere in state medical marijuana programs. And then Congress went one step further a couple weeks ago when they approved language expanding access to medical marijuana for military veterans. And I think this is a really significant distinction. In the past, Congress has taken steps that says we'll take a hands-off approach to what the states are doing. We're not doing anything to encourage the use of medical marijuana. We're just sort of staying to the sidelines. But that's not what they did 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, it was brought to their attention that military veterans in states where medical marijuana is permitted are having difficulty obtaining medical marijuana because their physicians, the physicians that work for the VA's office, are forbidden from talking to them about marijuana and recommending medical marijuana. That's a problem. That's limiting their access. What's Congress going to do about that? And Congress said, we are going to do something about that. We are going to lift the prohibition that currently exists on those VA doctors, and we are going to allow them to have those conversations so they can make those recommendations. That's not a hands-off approach. That is a proactive approach. Congress has taken the first step that I can remember. To expand, to proactively allow people to have access to medical marijuana that otherwise wouldn't have it. It is inconceivable that a majority of Congress could vote to expand access to a Schedule I drug that they truly believe is as dangerous as heroin and has no accepted medical use. That is a complete conflict with the scheduling. Again, when we actually survey physicians and we ask them their attitudes on medical marijuana, remember Madras said the majority, in fact, the vast majority, are against the use of medical marijuana. Well, that's actually not what the data says. The New England Journal of Medicine surveyed physicians in 2013. More than three quarters of them with an opinion said they favored medical marijuana. WebMD did a similar survey, and they found about 70% of their physicians favored the use of medical marijuana. She talks about maybe the individual parts of marijuana have value, but not the plant itself. That's a way to try and reject what we call the ensemble or the entourage effect, the notion that the majority or that there are a number of therapeutic components in cannabis, including also naturally occurring terpenes and other parts of the plant, and that these components are most therapeutic, they're most beneficial when used in concert with one another. We have data on this, and Sanjay Gupta has talked about this as eloquently as anybody on his own special specific to cannabis. Of course, Ms. Madras criticizes smoking, but again, we know there are multiple other types of delivery devices as alternatives to smoking, like tinctures, edibles, topicals, and we know that vaporization in clinical trial evidence has shown that it can reduce or not result in exposure of combustive gases. I also argue that it's a much more efficient delivery system for cannabinoids because when we look at the blood levels of individuals who have recently vaporized cannabis versus individuals who have smoked cannabis, we find higher levels of cannabinoids in their blood levels as opposed to the others. So clearly we have a safe alternative rapid onset delivery device already available. This is arguably my favorite slide. I talk about it all the time because this to me just exposes this sort of longstanding narrative that we continue to have in this country that says we just don't know enough about cannabis. It just hasn't been studied enough. Like Bertha Madras said, we just don't know enough about cannabis. Hillary Clinton said this recently on the campaign trail. She said, we have no scientific study of marijuana. Zero. Nothing. So my retort then is, what the hell is all this? I mean, what is this? This is when you go into PubMed. PubMed is the repository for all peer-reviewed scientific research published anywhere in the world. And you type in a keyword, you can data mine search. You want to see how many peer-reviewed scientific papers exist in this repository on any particular subject you want to type in. Type in climate change, whatever. In this case, I type in marijuana. I want to see how many peer-reviewed scientific papers exist because we're told there's not enough. In some cases, we're told there's none at all. But PubMed disagrees. You type marijuana into PubMed, and you get over 23,450 scientific journal articles specific to marijuana. About 10,000 of those have been published just in the last 5 years. And to give you some idea of the significance of that volume of literature, type in some really well-recognized therapeutic drugs like Tylenol. You don't even get 20,000 published papers. Yeah, there's a lot of articles out there about Tylenol, but not as many as there are devoted to cannabis. Type in ibuprofen. You don't even get half the volume of literature. Ritalin. You don't even get a third. Hydrocodone. You don't get a 20th. Adderall. Again, you don't even get a 20th of the research. What's interesting, too, about Adderall is I update this chart with some regularity, but every 6 months or so go by. And each time I update it, the number of marijuana-related studies goes up by about 800 or 1,000. The number of Adderall-related studies goes up by like one. But there is no narrative going on in this country that says, we don't know enough about Adderall. We don't have adequate study about hydrocodone. So why, as advocates, do we accept that language when it comes to marijuana? If 23,450 scientific studies aren't enough, if that's not adequate, will somebody please define what the adequate number is? More importantly, we have this unique experience with cannabis which is that humans have consumed cannabis for thousands of years, providing us with ample empirical evidence as to its relative safety and efficacy over the long term. We don't have that with a number of these other drugs. What are the long-term effects of Adderall? Who the hell knows? It's a fairly new created drug. What are the long-term effects of statins like Crestor? Someone's going to be prescribed Crestor for their cholesterol when they're 40. They're likely going to be on Crestor every day for the rest of their life. They might use that drug for the next 40 years, the next 50 years. What are the effects? Who the hell knows? No one in this society has ever used that drug that way for that long. We have no idea. But we understand what happens when societies use cannabis long term because historically societies have been using cannabis long term. So not only has it been studied to greater scientific scrutiny, we also have a greater, broader lens of empirical data. Let's see, I think I went backwards again here. So again, just stressing on this notion that cannabis is widely studied, you can give a slide like that, and opponents will say, like Bertha Madras, will say, yes, you may have these tens of thousands of studies, but they're not the right kind of studies. They're not the double-blind, placebo-controlled, gold standard clinical trials. And she's right to a degree, because obviously not all 23,450 of those studies meet that gold standard criteria. But about 120 of them do. And when we see summaries of those gold standard studies, we see results like this from Igor Grant and his team. They say, based on the evidence currently available, the Schedule I classification is not tenable. It is not accurate that cannabis has no medical value or that information on safety is lacking. We introduced this paper to the court on half a dozen of occasions. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm aware of that. But, yeah. So, I think this is important to keep in mind, too. We certainly brought this up during our evidentiary hearings. Now, I mentioned we have these 23,450 studies. I mentioned that of those studies, about 120 of them fit this gold standard criteria, the way we scientifically assess safety and efficacy. And I want you to understand that number in context, because you might be under the belief that before the FDA approves a drug, that it goes through hundreds and hundreds of those gold standard criteria. But that actually isn't the case at all. There was an excellent review published in JAMA, and again, we introduced this to the court in 2014. And researchers wanted to see just how many gold standard trials a new drug in development went through before the FDA said, that's enough. We've seen all the data we need to see to make a determination about safety and efficacy. So they looked at the years 2005 to 2012, and they said during this time period, the FDA approved 188 new drugs for the market. And the average number of those gold standard clinical trials the FDA reviewed before they said, we've seen enough evidence to be persuaded that the adequate science has been completed, was 2. And in more than a third of the new drugs approved by the FDA, the approval was based on a single clinical gold standard trial. So for some reason, for some drugs, one study is adequate study enough. But for cannabis, 23,450 studies is still inadequate. Yeah, that's true. That they were never tested on. Right, of course. Same thing with prescription to children, because very rarely were the drugs ever given to adolescents in clinical development. So again, Madras goes on the same argument. She says, marijuana can't be used safely. So we're getting to the third criteria. Because, quote, we have no adequate understanding of the plant's composition. We don't have studies involving large cohorts of subjects. There's a lack of long-term evaluations of safety. And there exist those, quote, unquote, negative side effects. So let's address those here at the end. Looks like I just did something. Oops. Okay. I don't see a green arrow. I hit escape the first time by accident.
Push what you just did, the slideshow, right?
I did.
Okay, so then push that.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you. So we're told we don't know. This is really interesting to me. She says we don't know the composition of marijuana. I'm sure you've heard this all too. They say there's 420 chemicals in marijuana. I mean, how could we ever understand them? Well, really, there's only about a dozen compounds in marijuana, specific cannabinoids, that we pay attention to. And you know what? We've got a pretty damn good understanding of them. In fact, I've identified the majority of those compounds a whole long time ago. CBN, cannabinol, was first identified in 1896. CBD, this new Cinderella drug on the market. We're hearing about CBD like Sanjay Gupta and the Stanley Brothers just discovered it a few weeks ago. You know, it was identified before Mishulam even identified THC, 1940. This drug's been around for almost a century. THC identified in 64, CBG identified in 64, CBC in 66, THCV in 1970. The composition of marijuana is well understood and well identified. And we have either privately produced or federally produced programs, like the privately produced program in Great Britain through GW Pharmaceuticals, or the Israel's Ministry of Health program, or the Netherlands Ministry of Health program, or even our University of Mississippi program, where these programs grow marijuana for research purposes and provide marijuana to patients, over 22,000 in Israel, for instance. And this is a reproducible product that they provide to these patients. If you go to this link under the University of Mississippi, you go to NIDA's marijuana menu. And they've got about 65 different strains of marijuana you can choose from. And it tells you all about the distinguishing factors of each strain. The CBD volume, the THC volume, the CBN volume. Obviously, we understand the composition of marijuana and have for quite some time. That's not an issue. And because we have some of these state-sponsored trials, we have assessments of cohorts of patients that have used marijuana long-term. These are some of the results we see from these trials. The first one comes from Israel. This was a long-term trial where patients used cannabis every day for a period of at least 7 months. And the result was daily cannabis use was associated with reduced pain, improved quality of life, reduced opioid use, and very few what we call significant adverse side effects. Nobody was dropping out of this trial because they felt the unwanted effects of cannabis were so significant. This was a study, again, I referenced it earlier, just published in JAMA. It's a longitudinal study from New Zealand. They followed these people since birth. They followed their marijuana use from teen years to midlife. These people have been using marijuana for over 20 years. They wanted to see if there were any significant health effects associated with their cholesterol, their heart, their internal organs, their lung function. And what they found was, after 20 years, cannabis use was unrelated to health problems in early midlife across several domains of health, periodontal health, lung function, systemic inflammation, and metabolic health. Clear evidence of a diverse association with cannabis use was apparent for only one domain, periodontal health. These people had dry gums. And they have dry gums because we know one of the potential adverse effects of inhaling cannabinoids is dry mouth and a lack of saliva secretion. That would not be surprising to find that result. And it's amazing if you read the media coverage this week. This is being highlighted. You would think these researchers went into the study only looking to see if there was an association between marijuana use and poor periodontal health, because that's what the headline tells you, and that's what 98% of the coverage tells you. And it ignores the fact that on these major other issues they were looking at, they found no difference between marijuana users and non-marijuana users. The Journal of Pain, this study comes from the Canadians Federal Marijuana Program. Individuals in this program were using marijuana to treat cancer pain. They were using it for well over 2 years. This was an interesting study because they matched these individuals with controls that were also had cancer pain, but were not using medical marijuana for this period of time. And what they found was in reduction to greater quality of life, the daily users of marijuana showed no significant adverse changes in cognitive skills, pulmonary function, or any endocrine function compared to the non-users. And then we have a review in 2002 of the federal government's own medical marijuana program. The federal government doesn't track any information from its own program. It simply gives a select group of patients 300 marijuana-rolled cigarettes every month and lets them go on their way. So some private researchers at Missoula University actually monitored. They did a blood workup of those patients, patients who arguably use greater quantities of marijuana than anyone else in existence. And again, they found no significant adverse effects in that cohort due to their marijuana use. Now, when we look at the side effect profile of most common therapeutic drugs, we see a whole host of significant adverse effects, like risk of death, kidney failure, ulcer, heart attack. That's why the average drug label lists at least 70 adverse side effects associated with the proper prescription use of the drug. And it's not uncommon to see as many as 500 written adverse side effects written right on the label. And again, these are adverse side effects when that drug is used as prescribed. Not when the drug is abused. This is when the drug is used properly. Yet, the Journal of the Canadian Medical Association published a report, an important one, in 2008, where they reviewed over 30 clinical trials involving cannabis-based drugs, those gold standard trials Bertha Madras is still looking for. And they want to know how many subjects in those trials withdrew from the trials over the course of that study because they complained of significant adverse side effects, like the sort of side effects we saw with Tylenol and opioids and NSAIDs. And the answer was zero. In 4 decades worth of clinical trial work, they couldn't find a single subject who dropped out of a cannabis-based trial for significant side effects. They did find some that reported inadvertent side effects. This included, number one was cough, and number two was dry mouth, and number three was very curious. It was euphoria. So we see the side effect profile here. If we're going to compare cannabis' side effects to the side effects that we as a society accept for other therapeutic agents, or in some cases non-therapeutic agents like alcohol and nicotine, there's no question that marijuana, that the science establishes that marijuana meets this safety profile. We also know that cannabis is relatively non-toxic. The World Health Organization acknowledges that there's never been a confirmed case of human death of cannabis poisoning. We know that there's no lethal overdose potential associated with cannabis, and it has this exceptional effective dose in half to LD50 ratio. It means the range between a dose that can trigger a psychotropic effect versus the range that can trigger death in half of the subjects that use the drug at that dose is infinite. Unlike if we get down the list to more common drugs like codeine, which has a 20-to-1 safety ratio, alcohol, 10-to-1, dextromethorphan, which is simply a cough suppressant, and Robitussin, 10-to-1. This is why someone can line up 21 shots on their 21st birthday and literally drink themselves to death, because there's a very narrow window between the effective dose in half and the potentially lethal dose in half. I've got a couple minutes, so I'm going to wrap up here with these next couple slides. I want to say a note about evidence, because I hear this word thrown around all the time, and we should understand that all evidence is not weighted equally. And so basically here, I have sort of the weakest weighted evidence going to the strongest weighted evidence. Preclinical evidence is evidence that you find in animal data. From there, you move to survey data. Then you have reviews, meta-analyses. These are reviews of previously published work, but you're not doing original work. You have case reports or N-of-1 trials. This says, I'm a physician, I've overseen this particular patient using this therapy, and these are the results we got, but we don't have a control to compare it to. You have observational studies. These are important. You take big cohorts of people, you follow them, you see what happens to them. You have case control, not longitudinal. This means we haven't followed these people for a long time. Or you have case control, longitudinal. This means we started with these people at birth. We follow how their behavior is. We match them with people who don't engage in that behavior, and we see if there's any differences. That's how most marijuana-related research is done. And then you have your gold standard clinically controlled trial. That is the best standard. That's your strongest evidence. What is interesting is, like I said earlier, we've got about 120 papers that fall into this latter criteria. When the federal government's arguing marijuana has harm, they have zero. They don't have a single placebo-controlled trial. They largely rely on preclinical evidence, a little survey evidence, and some observational data. So the question is, we asked this to Bertha Madras, and she couldn't answer it on the stand, is why must this only the stringent gold standard evidence methods be used to question marijuana schedule and status when such methods have never been used to even allege marijuana meets marijuana Schedule 1 criteria. Nonetheless, the judge wasn't persuaded, at least as much as we needed to be. We needed her to be. She said there is little or no basis for concluding that marijuana is a dangerous substance as some other drugs in Schedule 1. That was nice to hear. She said, but relative dangerousness is not the test the court applies in resolving the constitutional question before it. She said that we as defendants had not met our, quote, heavy burden of proving the irrationality of the Schedule 1 classification of marijuana because we have not negated, quote, every conceivable basis that might support it. The record here does not demonstrate that there is only one supportable point of view about marijuana's safe medical value or abuse potential. Essentially, she was saying because Bertha Madras has a curriculum vitae and doesn't quite sound insane and believes what she said and everyone else doesn't, well, there's still not a consensus. There's not just one supportable view. And she concluded, she said, in view of the principal disagreements among reputable scientists and practitioners regarding the potential benefits and detrimental effects of marijuana, the court cannot say that its placement on Schedule 1 is so arbitrary or so unreasonable as to render it unconstitutional. Congress still could rationally choose one side of the debate over the other. Now, I want to finish with this slide because, again, in July, we're going to see all of this revisited again when the DEA makes a decision regarding marijuana scheduling. I know a lot of people get really excited about this notion of what would happen if the DEA moved marijuana from, say, 1 to 2. I'm not excited about that at all. And I will say that in our federal challenge, we were not asking for that. We were asking for the judge to simply say it didn't belong in Schedule 1. And therefore, she could have put it anywhere. She could have removed it altogether. We were not recommending she put it somewhere. We were simply saying where it should not be. Here's the problem with moving marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2. It doesn't amend 280E. Any marijuana-compliant business is still going to have to pay all the taxes they're already paying if they move marijuana from 1 to 2. It doesn't permit banking. All the problems businesses have with banking right now, they're going to keep having if marijuana is moved to 2. It doesn't amend federal drug testing workplace mandates. Anyone who's drug tested because the feds say they need to be drug tested will still be drug tested with this change. It does not expedite clinical cannabis research. This is the big one. I hear this all the time. We'll just have more research as we move it to 2. How? All of the research that uses marijuana must go through the FDA. It must go through the NIDA. It must go through DEA. And all of that marijuana that's using that research must go through the University of Mississippi. That's not because marijuana is a Schedule 1 drug. It's because it's marijuana. Marijuana's criteria for research are different than Schedule 1 controlled drugs. If you want to do research with heroin, you don't have to go through the University of Mississippi to get it. You go through a privately licensed provider to get it. That change does not expedite research. We would have to change the actual regulations about marijuana to expedite research. And it maintains the intellectual dishonesty that cannabis is a comparatively dangerous drug on par with cocaine, which is Schedule 2, or methamphetamine, that's Schedule 3. We argue that rather cannabis, like alcohol and tobacco, should be removed from the CSA altogether. And I have significant doubts that the DEA is going to make such a change in July, but we can always hope. If you want more about me, there's some information Lauren may not have told you. I've got cards, and I will be around all 3 days for those who want to talk to me about any of these issues socially. Thank you guys for being a great, patient audience.